Perry Mason, the famous defense lawyer, first appeared on television in 1957 and lives on today in reruns. For two decades before that, generations of Americans devoured the tales of his trial conquests in books, 82 of them, with sales worldwide of some 300 million. Perry wasn't real, of course, though he became a part of our culture. He was the creation of Earl Stanley Gardner. As part of Present at the Creation, a series exploring the origins of American cultural icons, NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The real Earl Stanley Gardner started out as something of a juvenile delinquent, though by today's standards, one might just call him a maverick. He was often suspended from high school, and after a brief stint in college, left one step ahead of the law. Instead of learning in school, he apprenticed in a law firm and passed the bar exam. As his granddaughter, Valerie McKittrick, puts it,
he was very anti-authority. He, all of his life, did as he pleased.
Gardner became a successful lawyer in Ventura, California, but more and more he resisted the hours and the confines of the job. He loved the outdoors, being his own boss, and he always wanted to write, which he began doing in 1921 with a series of short stories for pulp magazines. By Gardner's own account, the stories were terrible. As he put it, he hadn't yet learned how to think on a typewriter. His first real break came when he got a rejection letter from Black Mask magazine with a scathing internal critique mistakenly attached. Undeterred, Gardner revised the story, using the critique as his guide. "I had been accustomed to standing up in police courts and dishing it out and taking it on the chin," he said. "It never occurred to me to get mad." He submitted the second version, and this time it sold. Gardner's first Perry Mason book came out in 1933. He had reworked it several times and badly wanted to avoid comparisons to Dashiell Hammett's style. As he wrote to his publisher, "I want to make my hero a fighter, not by having him ruthless with women and underlings, but by creating a character who, with infinite patience, jockeys his enemies into a position where he can deliver one good knockout punch." Mason's right-hand man, of course, was a woman, his, quote, confidential secretary, Della Street. There was never any overt sex, but in the manner of a striptease, the relationship between Mason and Della always seemed about to be revealed as more than professional.
Oh, you didn't tell me one of your accomplishments was starting fires.
Anytime you want me to put the heat on Lieutenant Trag, you just let me know.
I'll bear that in mind. Sometimes you even make it too hot for me.
By 1933, Gardner had stopped practicing law altogether and devoted himself full-time to writing. His method was unusual, to say the least. He had a 1930s version of a Winnebago, which he used to go into the desert along with a pool of secretaries. Cut off from civilization, he would dictate into a tape recorder, and the secretaries would transcribe. That way, he produced an astounding 100,000 words a month, more than 1 million words a year.
And there was a liberal sprinkling of sawdust on the floor. Paragraph, it was right here, Mr. Mason. She said there was a pool of blood and several dots. It's gone. Paragraph, Mason.
He called it the fiction factory, and according to his granddaughter, he was intent on a certain degree of verisimilitude.
He was a stickler for accuracy. So every time he had a murder committed, he bought a gun for each story. For one of the books, there was somebody to die in the bathtub, and he filled the tub up and shot a hole at the angle he wanted to see how far it would go, when the water would run out, and what the angle was. And I don't know who repaired that tub, but grandmother had a fit.
In the early part of his career, Gardner still lived with his wife, who at one time had been his secretary. But his forays into the desert and his purchase of a remote ranch were more than she could take, and the two separated, though never divorced. For decades, his secretarial pool consisted of three sisters, and to some extent, they became the staple of his professional and personal life, according to his longtime agent and friend, Larry Hughes.
One was Jean, and she was his secretary, and many people feel that she was the real model for Della Street. Then there was Honey. Now, Honey was Jean's sister, and Honey took care of the bookkeeping, and then Peggy was the hostess. It was obvious that Jean was the boss.
Indeed, after Gardner's estranged wife died, he married Jean. As the Mason books became more and more popular, Hollywood tried to cash in with a series of movies. But Gardner had no control over how his character was used, and all the movies were duds, including one where Perry was a cowboy in a Western. Perry Mason on the radio, however, was a hit, though again, Gardner had little control over the scripts and pretty much hated the show for its 12-year run. So when TV came calling, Gardner decided to form his own production company, almost unheard of at the time. He picked the cast, reviewed all the scripts, hired lawyers as writers, and split the profits with the network. Although Gardner told TV Guide that he had never had a physical vision of what Perry Mason looked like, he obviously did have a picture in his mind's eye because he picked Raymond Burr to play the part without hearing him speak. Author Brian Kelleher, who wrote about the TV series, says Burr came in to read for the part of the prosecutor, Hamilton Berger.
Before a word came out of his mouth, Earl Stanley Gardner, so they say, jumped off his chair and said, "That's him, that's Perry Mason." And that's how he got the part.
You know, Evelyn, I'm half tempted to believe you. But if this is your gun and you have lied to me about it, I can't help you.
The show featured big stars like Betty Davis and unknowns like Robert Redford. In the final episode, Dick Clark is the murderer.
He was an egomaniac. He stepped on people for the sheer enjoyment of it.
And the judge is Earl Stanley Gardner.
Court stands adjourned until 2 o'clock this afternoon.
The music, written by Fred Steiner, became a signature of the program. Composer Steiner says he'd read a lot of Perry Mason novels and tried to write something that combined the two sides of Mason, the urbane, successful lawyer, and the criminal lawyer who deals with lowlife and danger.
And in those days, rhythm and blues was the big thing, sort of represented the seamier side of life. Don't ask me why, that's a sociological question.
Perry Mason fans ranged from Harry Truman to Albert Einstein and lawyer-author Scott Turow.
I had a sort of steady date with Perry on Saturday night.
The TV show and the books taught Turow something about writing.
What I took from Perry Mason and Charles Dickens was the childlike delight in the surprise and in plot as revelation of character, in the sense that the significant turn of the plot ends up deepening your understanding of somebody and, you know, what they had at stake in the situation.
So, what did you do?
I figured it out. If I killed him, I could get the money. I could get the money and get away from her.
Perry Mason entered the culture and changed it, says author Turow. Now laymen and lawyers alike expect that if a client's innocent, his lawyer should be able to prove it. Still, why was the public so captivated by Mason, not just here, but in 50 other countries? Turow believes it's the deftness of the plots.
Sometimes they're still really clever. You know, there's smoke from many different directions. And I think that that remains the fundamental part of their appeal, which is that people love the puzzle.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.